You're listening to Money Management, powered by the Opus 111 Group. Here with a fresh perspective on the market, the economy, and your money. From the Spokane office of the Opus 111 Group, Mike Mayle.
Thank you, sir. Welcome again, everyone, to our weekly gathering of financial common sense, brought to you in what I hope is plain American. We are your antidote to conventional wisdom, so that you have an idea of what's really going on out there, and not by somebody just trying to sell you some toothpaste. So, we'll start with the data dump, let you know where all the indices ended, little news items. We'll talk about the economy, about the markets, and I want to focus a larger chunk of time on gold. I was going to do that last week, but we ran out of time and had a number of inquiries over the past week about it, and so here we go. With that in mind, let's get to the data. We did have two new all-time highs set by the indices this week. The S&P traded up to 5189, and that was on, it was yesterday. And the NASDAQ also yesterday trading up to 16,449 for an all-time high. So good data there. Now, the Dow ended the week at 38,722. The S&P finished just off its high at 5123. NASDAQ also lower than its high, did end Friday at 16,085. The Russell 2000 closed at 2,083. 10-year Treasury lower at 4.08%. Crude closed at $78.01 a barrel. Soft white wheat at $5.71 a bushel. Gold at $21.84 an ounce, off a little bit from its high. And silver at $24.49 an ounce. Now, coming on Tuesday, we'll get the Consumer Price Index report for February. See just which way inflation at our level is trending. And then Thursday next week, we'll be getting the jobless claims and retail sales data and see how consumers are faring. Now, there was one thing that happened yesterday I want to touch on that is related to, it's all related, but has to do with the changes in prices. You know that company, NVIDIA. They had a most interesting day yesterday. Well, they've had a most interesting few months, actually. But yesterday, the stock opened at, $951, traded up to $974. That's an all-time high. And then it sold off. Apparently, the traders decided, it's the weekend. We don't know what's going on. It's up a lot. Let's take some profits. So they sold it big time. It was ended the day, the week, this is NVIDIA, at $875.28, down $51.41. Now, that sounds like a lot, and it is, but it's only 5%, and it's still positive for the week. So you're getting a lot of this action based on what traders are perceiving is changing. And that does not, in many instances, relate to fundamentals. So be careful how you respond to the news that you hear. So, and then this week, we had Mr. Powell, Mr. Jerome Powell, he of the Federal Reserve, holding forth in front of Congress. And he said that the central bank could lower interest rates this year. But he also said he's not immediately ready to cut the cost of those rates. And I'm quoting, he said, we believe that our policy rate is likely to, at its peak for this tightening cycle, so that's good. If the economy evolves broadly as expected, it will likely be appropriate to begin dialing back policy restraint at some point this year, unquote. Now, as I mentioned, he didn't give anybody any timetable for when this would happen, but coming soon is a lot better than someday my prince will come, which is where a lot of the traders have been operating. Mr. Powell went on to say, and I'm quoting also, we're waiting to become more confident that inflation is moving sustainably at 2%. When we do get that confidence, and we're not far from it, it'll be appropriate to begin to dial back that level of restriction. He added that, and this is what they're concerned about, that the cuts would be so that the Fed does not drive the economy into recession rather than normalizing policy as the economy gets back to normal, unquote. Now, additionally, the European Central Bank held its key interest rates steady, and it also lowered forecasts for its annual inflation and growth. So that is also been construed as a positive signal on the international inflation front. And so, again, this came, their announcement, the ECB's announcement came after what Mr. Powell had to say. Adam Turnquist, chief technical strategist at LPL, said in response to this, the market was expecting it and they're finally hearing it from Fed officials. It just adds to the confidence that rate cuts are coming. And that lit off the markets on Tuesday, or Monday, I guess it was. And so that helped get the week off to a good start. Now, this, we added also, and again, this kind of a hodgepodge, just the way they showed up. But we added private sector jobs, 140,000 folks, and that was more than February. But it was slightly below, and I'm quoting, the forecast for 150,000 from economists, to which I say, so what? I mean, those numbers mean exactly the paper that they're printed on. So the trend is we're still hiring folks. As a matter of fact, hiring kept booming in February because yesterday we had the February jobs report and we added 275,000 jobs. Now, the tea leaf readers had only been looking for like 197,000 jobs. So this was, 198,000 jobs. And so that was way more than expected, again, showing that the economy is still strong. The national unemployment rate rose to 3.9% as more part-timers came to work. And let's see, wage growth a little bit lighter than expected. And again, this offering some hope that inflation has cooled enough to make the Fed feel all warm and toasty inside about dropping those rates. Interest rates dropped as a result of that data. Now, there's also been some commentary, more than a little, about our debt. And, just food for thought. The federal debt is the source of a lot of wailing and moaning about, impending doom. But what's missing from all this is that you have to understand from the big picture, making payments on this humongo amount of debt doesn't equate to just throwing money out the window. See, interest paid on the federal debt is a burden to taxpayers, to be sure. But it's also a source of income to those who hold the debt, some of those self-same taxpayers. It's a zero-sum game. No money's destroyed. It simply changes hands. What's important, however, is this. When the debt is the result of excessive government spending, no names, please, this means that the economy is squandering its resources. Why? Well, it's a fact. Government spending is almost always less efficient and way less productive than if the private sector were spending the same amount of money. Just think of all those hundreds of billions of dollars of fraud that accompany every big government spending program. And as the late lamented Dr. Milton Friedman said, debt isn't the problem, spending is the problem. And one thing here for folks who live in the vicinity of, say, Washington. Although the average U.S. household pays about $11,000 in Fed income tax, the amount that households have to come up with in both state and local taxes changes a lot across the country. Taxpayers in the most tax-expensive states pay more than double what the amount is of those in the least tax-expensive states pay. This is from WalletHub. And I won't go through the laundry list, but here's one that's kind of close at heart. In addition to their burden of U.S. tax, Illinois is the lead leaguer. I can't even talk. League leader, paying an additional 16.5%. But wait, what's this? Number 15 is the state of Washington, paying 12% above more than what other people around the country have to pay. So I'll let you noodle on that in the privacy of your own home. So where are we? Ah, yes, the market. Henry Kaufman, he was in the 80s. Was it the 80s? Yeah, in the 80s, he was considered Dr. Doom. Everybody listened to what he had to say, and people would make trades based on his thoughts. But in any regard, he was an economist for Salomon Brothers. He had this quote. There are two kinds of people who lose money, those who know nothing and those who know everything. So tell that brother-in-law to just put a sock in it, okay? Little trip in the history machine to kind of give you a hint of not everybody, as I was saying earlier, Henry Kaufman, the economist, had said two kinds of people lose money, those who know nothing and those who know everything. Well, on March 7th in the year 2000, according to my map, that's just about 24 years ago. Excuse me. Yeah, 24 years ago, exactly. Alan Greenspan was chairman of the Fed at that time, and he had been warning that stock prices were too high for a long time. But then, in March of 2000, he seemed to endorse what were then the stratospheric prices of what the tech shares. He was telling a conference that business investment in high-tech equipment and software had no end in sight. 4 days later, the NASDAQ peaked. And that's before it began tumbling in the worst market drop since 1929. Now, one would assume that Mr. Greenspan had some ability to get information from folks, and yet his conclusions were, might I say, inaccurate. And this part of the program, I apologize if you're not used to it. I give you just like little bits and pieces. They aren't necessarily tied together. It's just things I come across during the week that I think are of interest to y'all. So, you know, the thing you have to understand about markets, too, is that the averages go up a lot more slowly than they drop. And the reason is they call it volume is the friend of the bull. In other words, there's a lot of people wanting to participate when it's a quote-unquote bull environment. A lot of people are trying to get in to buy things. They're buying and selling coincidentally and a number of issues. Whereas when the markets aren't so good, the numbers of willing buyers shrink. And so it's not a function of just a free fall drop. It's that, again, there aren't as many buyers. And so with fewer buyers, the speed with which the markets drop increases. An old war story from 1970, probably five it was. There was a company called Polaroid. You all remember Polaroid, right? Well, it was one of those. It was, I dare I say, kind of like an NVIDIA at its time. At this particular, this was in, I believe, February, it traded up to $125 a share. Now, later that same year, I believe it might have been October or November, don't quote me, but around in there, the price of that same company was like 20. That's a pretty big drop. There were no stock splits, nothing else, just straight down. And again, that was when the markets were way bad. So, you know, who knew? I mean, but it dropped quite a lot in a relatively short period of time. That kind of underscores what I was suggesting about the speed with which they drop as opposed to the speed with which they go up. Now, the Bespoke Investment Group has this had this to say this week. One of the seemingly largest disconnects in the market since the start of this year has been the market's ability to keep rallying even as the number of expected rate cuts, interest rate cuts, between now and the end of the year has practically been cut in half. You know, earlier this year, they were talking about it's going to get cut seven or eight times, and then, well, then maybe only six, you know. But regardless, the number is now below four, and I think there are some that say three, and some are even say none are needed. But for anyone who's been operating under the premise that it's been nothing but a Fed-fueled rally, nope, the recent divergence begs to differ. So, you know, in a nutshell, the prospect for fewer rate cuts isn't bearish for stocks if inflation continues to cool, as it's doing, and economic activity remains strong, as it has. Now, the data confirms these trends in inflation and economic activity. We've been getting more and more news about recession odds coming way down. Anybody ever see a recession? I haven't seen one. Anyway, as economists revise up their GDP forecast. You know, our economy has proven to be a lot less vulnerable to higher rates than was commonly supposed. And again, you know, just because you're smart doesn't mean you have a better understanding of where markets are going. There are those still arguing that the decline of inflation has raised what are called real rates, that is, interest rates after inflation, even while the nominal interest rate, in other words, the stated interest rate, has held steady. The problem with this view is that there's so little evidence anywhere in the economy that the inflation-adjusted rate is holding back real activity. Businesses are actively investing, payrolls are growing, output is expanding. Rafael Bostic, he's a member of the Federal Reserve Board. He's the president of the Atlanta Federal Reserve. He said he's talked to a bunch of executives who are chomping at the bit with readiness, eager to seize the moment that rate cuts materialize. He wrote in the Atlanta's Fed's website this week, he said, and I'm quoting, "I asked one gathering of business leaders if they were ready to pounce at the first hint of our interest rate cut. The response was an overwhelming yes." Now, as he also said, this very eagerness, this pent-up zeal to capitalize on perceived future conditions could inadvertently stoke the embers of inflation. So you got to be cool no matter what. Now, Tesla, what a surprise here. The stock dropped out of the top 10 U.S. companies by market cap Wednesday for the first time since January of last year. Again, just because it's been under pressure. See, they don't always go up, up, up. Costco, this was crazy. Costco yesterday dropped almost 8%. Why? Stay tuned. They reported a revenue miss for the fiscal second quarter. Now, the revenue came in at $58.4 billion. The tea leaf readers said they had to have 59.1. Okay. But their earnings beat estimates. So how does this make sense? It doesn't make sense. It makes sense from the context that it's a trading thing. The trader said, oop, sell on the news, you know, mixed reviews, let's take some profits, stock's been up like crazy. That's what you're seeing. You're going to be seeing, I believe, a lot in the near term here as these things start to roll over. There's going to be a lot of traders wanting to take profits. And okay, but that doesn't change the fundamental value of the company. Now, Apple got into some pressure this week because the European Commission, whomever those people are, fined the tech giant more than 1.8 billion euros, and the thing was about, that turns out to be a 1.9 real money, over the company's quote-unquote abusive app store rules for music streamers. They say the fine must, this is the commission talking, the fine must be sufficient to deter Apple from repeating present or similar infringement and a lot of other blather. Now, Apple responded with its own statement saying decision was reached despite the commission's failure to uncover any credible evidence of consumer harm and ignores realities of a market that is thriving, competitive, and growing fast. There's something else to this, too, I think. The total market capitalization of all European-based tech companies, of which there, I believe, are 15, is $2.7 trillion. Microsoft alone is $3 trillion, NVIDIA, $2.2 trillion, Apple, $2.6 trillion. These guys, I mean, it's like a mouse biting at your ankles, but Apple still has to put up with those people. Well, technically, I guess so do we. But the S&P 500, what they call GAAP earnings, GAAP, were up 22% over last year for the fourth straight quarter of positive year-over-year growth and the highest growth rate since the fourth quarter of 2021. That's from Charlie Bellello. And here's one that makes no sense to me. I'm sorry. But total assets and money market funds have hit a record $6 trillion, increasing by $1.2 trillion over the past year, doubling over the past 5 years. Okay. Well, I don't know what the money market rates have paid over the last 5 years, but I would submit it's maybe 1%. And the S&P is up around 70%, that's about 13.5% annualized, in the 2020 so far, despite the fact that we even experienced two bear markets. The S&P, if you put $100 in 2019, which is where this money fund thing covers, it would have turned into $186.65 in 2023. That's about 86.6%, again, about 14% a year. How can that be ignored? I feel sorry for those people who are cramming in that money market funds. It makes no sense, folks. A couple more comments about the market in general. Bank America's Savita Subramanian, sorry, Savita. Well, she's the latest strategist to ratchet up their target for the year for the S&P. They're now up among the highest on Wall Street after, well, quite frankly, this year's rally has left most forecasters looking rather clueless. She now expects the benchmark to end the year at 5,400. She had an earlier target of 5,000, and it closed yesterday about 5,100. So the indicators are flashing bullish signals on basically stronger earnings growth ahead, and surprising profit margin resilience, she said. Remember, earnings is what drives stock prices. She went on to add, bull markets end with euphoria, and we're not there yet. Sentiment has improved, but areas of actual euphoria are limited. And oh boy, is that true. You don't have all that money in money market funds when you have euphoria. That's for dang sure. And, you know, overall, conditions remain solid. You know, volatility is quite possible, but I don't know. You can't complain about volatility. What does it mean? Volatility simply means prices go up and down. That's it. They aren't bad unto themselves. And while the trends remain very positive, in my occasionally humble opinion, risk could increase over the next couple of months. But given the strong economic fundamentals, these things are something to watch for, not to plan on. And by the way, you know, after strong rallies such as we've been enjoying, what's happened next is, and this is according to Deutsche Bank, the S&P has actually continued to advance over the next 6 to 12 months on every occasion. And what's different this time is the economy never fell into a recession from which it had to recover. So presumably that may mean that we've got a leg up on that. So we'll see. Now about gold. Well, gold prices did move to a record nominal high on Friday. Nominal, it means, in other words, whatever the prices they're telling you. In other words, it's, what the heck was it, $2,185.19. They base that on that data I mentioned earlier about the unemployment rate rising just a little bit more than expected and boosting expectations the Fed could begin cutting the interest rate soon. So let's just put this in perspective. So gold is at 2185. On the 3rd of March a year ago, it was 1853. On the 2nd of January this year, it was 2051. And 16th of February, it was 2208. So with all this in the news, investors are paying more attention and wondering if it is indeed time to actually put gold in their portfolios. Now, for the record, full disclosure, I don't want to get tased by anybody. I have been and remain a leading naysayer about owning gold, specifically for the long term. But in fact, is this time different? Well, I'm going to stick with the facts and not emotions here. So see what you think. So let's begin with gold's biggest liability. With the exception of a single decade, it has not been a good long-term investment. The 1970s were a total outlier for gold. President Nixon ended the government's promise to convert dollars to gold at a fixed price. It's also when they put on wage price control, definitely a bad idea. But in any case, that saw the price of an ounce go from the fixed average price of $36 in 1970, $36 an ounce, to $615 in 1980. But that amazing rise was a total abnormality. It was driven by the combination of pent-up demand from the price controls and a, let's just call it, a crazy decade of slow growth and high inflation. Now, what was the true value, top value of this stuff? Well, according to Peter Buchvar, and Peter's a pretty straight shooter, I believe, he's chief investment officer at Bleakley Financial, The gold contract, futures contract, was created in 1974. And then in 1980, the price was, it hit $3,200. So that's adjusted for inflation. So that's the real high, not $2,100, $3,200. Now, just saying, but after, carry the 44 years, is that right? And you still haven't hit its all-time high, I can't see that as a real makes me feel like, boy, I need to put money in this stuff. Anyway, in the past, gold has generally correlated well with real interest rates. In other words, gold's done well when interest rates are going down once you account for inflation. And as many folks know, the most convenient way today to own the metal is through an exchange-traded fund, such as the SPDR Gold Shares. That's GLD. That's the symbol for it. And its value is directly linked to the price of gold bullion. And over the past 10 years, those gold shares, that ETF, has returned an annualized return of 5.1%. That compares with 11.9% for the S&P 500 ETF, the SPY, S-P-Y, over the same period of time. Now, your investment of $10,000 in the gold fund became $16,445 over those 10 years. Same amount into the SPY ETF became $30,782. Now, I don't, you know, that to me says more. Now, the gold ETF lost money in five of the past 10 calendar years and beat the S&P in only three. If you go back to 1981, President Reagan and his Federal Reserve chief, the man with the big cigar, Paul Volcker, would move to set America's economic house in order by raising interest rates to crush inflation and thus crushing gold as well. And it took 27 years for the price of gold to get back to its nominal 1980 level. You know, it was essentially controlled by the government. The price of gold was essentially controlled by the government until 1971 when they took the gold standard away. And from 71 to 2023, gold was up 7.9% per year. Now, the S&P return of 10.8% over that same period was, again, somewhat better. So there's some diversification benefits. But the 1970 returns require some context, too. See, because the returns are front-loaded to the 70s. Remember I said the 70s is an anomaly for gold. From 71 to 79, gold was up nearly 1,300%. Holy camoli, that's a bunch. And that was good enough for a 9-year annual return of 33.8% per year. So $10,000 invested in gold at the end of 1970 would have been worth $160,000 by the end of the decade. But you couldn't buy ETFs. You could only buy bullion and coins at that time. So some would say gold was an amazing inflation hedge. Others would say, and that would be including yours truly, that the returns were simply playing catch-up from the decades when the government artificially held the prices down. Now, if you look at the gains in gold since 1980, they tell a much different story. From 80 to 23, gold was up just 3.2% a year. In that same period, stocks were up 11.7%, bonds rose by 6.5%, and even cash was up 4%. When you can't outperform cash, you're not doing too good. And in that same period, the annual inflation rate was 3.2%. So gold had a real return over 44 years of nothing, of zero. Once again, doesn't make me feel all warm and toasty about its appeal as a long-term investment. And, in fact, and you can check it out, do your own math, the price of gold has trailed the consumer price index, the inflation rate, since 1980. And this thing's supposed to be an inflation hedge. I don't understand why people will tell you that with a straight face. So, since 1990, gold's gone from $386 an ounce to the recent record of $2189. So, that's an increase of a factor of, well, less than six. And yet, over the same period, the Dow moved higher by a factor of 14. Gold increased again, less than 6%. Stocks at 8% annually. So any calculations, and this is true for any investment, depends on where you start. But going back, if you go do any analysis after 1980, gold has risen at a far lower rate than has stocks. You know, it's important to note that gold hasn't done much on a long-run basis outside of the 70s. There still have been a few periods where it provided some diversification benefits. For example, from 2000 to 2009, S&P down about 1% a year. In that same decade, gold was up more than 14% on an annual basis. And stocks have outperformed in 15 years or so since the end of that time. And since 2009 through 2023, gold has risen 6%, and S&P is up 13.8%. And if you want the longer-term view, A gentleman named Aswath Damodaran, I'm sorry, Aswath Damodaran, added gold to, he runs a historical return data at NYU. In any regard, considering the S&P 500, 10-year treasuries, 3-month T-bills, and gold going back to 1928 through 2023, the average annual return, and again, average annual return for stocks is up 9.8%. For bonds, it was up 4.6%. For gold, up 4.9%. And for cash, 3.3% higher. So gold's done better than bonds and cash, but it's way behind stocks by a good bit. Now, understand, too, that from 1928 to 1970, gold was up just 1.4% a year, less than the annual inflation rate of 2% over that entire period. So you tell me why it's a good investment long term, because I don't get it. And as a commodity with no significant industrial use, gold prices increase mainly with the cheapening of dollars used to buy it. That is the effect of inflation, plus the emotions, mostly fear, of the buyers. Global geopolitical uncertainty and apprehension over economic activity are likely to benefit the demand for gold. Gold also benefited from the rising wealth around the world, which drives the demand for jewelry. And that demand is counterbalanced by an increasing supply, which has come through better mining. Production having risen, gold production having risen 50% since 1997. You know, stocks, by contrast, they go up in value because of the underlying individual companies. Their value is determined by the combination of the imagination and hard work of the folks who manage and work in them. See, when you invest in these individual companies, you are an owner. You're a part owner in that business. You get access to those brains and the hard work. For example, you've been able to ride along with the inventors of a phone that can tell you everything about the world and let you video chat with folks half a world away. You can work with the engineers who figured out how to drill for oil sideways. That's the frackers. The scientists who developed treatments to put cancer into remission. Builders of those cruise ships you like to hang out on to carry 8,000 folks. The fashion designers who make that yoga wear, and streaming media providers who make it possible to watch something whenever and wherever you please. You know, but you know, gold certainly has a, how would I, somewhat undeserved mystique as a haven, in my opinion. But in times of catastrophe, gold's record is mixed at best. Yeah, in 08, gold rose 5%, stocks were down 38%. That was a one-year turn. And then when the pandemic struck in early 20, the S&P index fell 34% in just over 5 weeks, while gold held nearly all its value. However, after 9/11, for example, gold and stocks were about the same. And when it comes to safe havens, U.S. Treasury bonds have typically been a much better bet, and they pay interest. And have I mentioned, gold doesn't pay dividends, doesn't pay interest. Stocks do. And those returns that I've been mentioning to you don't even include the dividends in those data. And to add insult to injury, if you had gold in the form of bullion or coins, you probably have had to pay a fee to store that stuff, unless you got a really good place in the backyard, which I would not recommend doing. You know, gold has done better than bonds and cash, but trailed the market by the stock market by a bit. And, you know, that's just the way it is. It's stocks have risen over time. And while for sure, not every month or every year, say even today, or excuse me, Friday, when it was down just a bit. But when you look at increments, when you're talking about for retirement planning and other long-term needs, in increments over 10 years or more, you're going to see a rise. Not for gold. The case for gold, in my view, should be at best short-term. And, you know, you've got to be careful. You know, you say don't time the market. Don't try to guess the market. I don't know how else you do that with gold in these circumstances. It's about the only way you can make money, because as what seems fairly plain to me is that over the long term, this stuff has never well, 1926 never worked out for a long-term investment. So, you know, investors, I think, have become or are becoming more relaxed about inflation. Again, with the Fed recently signaling that the cuts in the interest rates may very well be on the way in our lifetime. And, of course, there's the world itself with more unknowns. You know, the bottom line is that over the long run, there's really only one rational long-term investment goal for your portfolio. It's not growth. It's not income. It's kind of a hybrid. It's growth of income. Growth of your income to support your lifestyle out into the future. A growth that grows in excess of the inflation rate plus a little. Gold has not provided that. You know, maybe you could make a case, put some in a portfolio, fine. But for the most part, you will definitely underperform, based on the record, if you are a gold human and that's, you think, is the only way to do things. Or worse yet, a gold human and a money market human at the same time. You know, the growth of the S&P's dividend, it has grown since 1980 at just about twice the consumer inflation rate. So it's like, that dividend, it's like they say, it's like Rodney Dangerfield. For those of you who don't know, Rodney Dangerfield used to say, I get no respect. And that's kind of what the dividends for the S&P get, no respect. But consider this, about 37% of last year's total return for the S&P was due to dividends. That's a pretty good chunk. So you can't just poo-poo it and, you know, pretend it doesn't exist. And one final thing from World Gold Council market strategist named Joseph Cavatoni. Mr. Cavatoni offers this. A low interest rate environment translates into reduced opportunity cost of holding non-yielding gold and weighs on the dollar, making bullion cheaper for overseas buyers. Rate cut bets, are also driving gold prices, and everyone is expecting they will come. So, near term, yeah, you can probably see gold move higher. Fine. But don't put your future into that. I would hope that based on the data you've heard, you'd see that that is not a great place for concentrating your retirement assets or any other long-term assets for that matter. So with that, I will cease and desist. Next Saturday. Next Saturday, we will be absent. Going to be on the road again, me and Willie, but I hope you'll have a fine week. And don't forget, the Zagmos start again on Tuesday, and we got to cheer them on the final victory so they can once again wreak havoc upon those foul and evils from Moraga. So thank you very much for listening. I totally appreciate it. My name is Mike Mayo. I'm with the Opus 111 Group, and you've been listening to Money Management. I thank you for doing so.
Join us again next week at this same time for the financial insight, opinion, and perspective of Money Management with Mike Mayo, powered by the Opus 111 Group. Have a question, comment, or want to find out if you'd be a good fit with Opus 111? Email us at info@opus111group.com or visit our website, opus111group.com. Sections of this radio show contain forward-looking statements that are not guarantees of future performance. This information is from sources we believe to be reliable. However, we cannot guarantee that it is accurate or complete. These comments are for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, nor as a recommendation to buy or sell any security or investment product mentioned in this show. Investment involves risk and is not indicative of future results. Individual circumstances do vary. Please consult an investment professional prior to making any investment decisions.